This is Mark Sobel, U.S. Chair of OMFIF. Today, I have the great honor of being joined by Paul Tucker for a podcast on international financial regulatory issues. We are doing so from the offices of Hamilton Place Strategies, thanks to my good friend and former colleague, Tony Fratto, and one of Hamilton Place Strategies' founders. One could spend hours introducing Sir Paul Tucker, given his unparalleled and distinguished career. He joined the Bank of England in 1980, rose quickly through its ranks. He was appointed a member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee and Executive Director for Markets from June 2002, and he became Deputy Governor of the Bank of England in March 2009. Since late 2013, Paul has been at Harvard. In December 2015, Paul became Chair of the Systemic Risk Council, a body set up in 2012 by former regulators and central bankers to promote financial stability. He has recently authored an impressive volume, Unelected Power, The Quest for Legitimacy in Central Banking and the Regulatory State. I had the great honor to get to know Paul through G20 and FSB discussions during and in the aftermath of the global financial crisis, especially because the U.S. and U.K. often sit next to each other in international fora, thanks to the wonders of alphabetical ordering. He was an active participant in the BIS and FSB, and he is the architect of much of the framework developed by the FSB on cross-border bank resolution, including leading the effort to formulate and assemble the key attributes for effective resolution regimes. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's great to see you, and it's great to be doing this podcast with you.
Well, thank you. We thank you at OMFIF. So before we delve into nitty-gritty, can you briefly tell us about Systemic Risk Council, what it is, what it does, and if it has a prevailing ethos or philosophy? My sense is that the Systemic Risk Council is a strong proponent of forceful and intelligent financial regulation.
Thanks, Mark. The Systemic Risk Council was established in 2012 to be a body of mainly former central bankers and regulators who argue, campaign even, for maintaining a stable financial system, sometimes protecting the authorities, the central banks and regulators from the industry, sometimes trying to stiffen the backbone of the authorities. It's sponsored and was established by the CFAI, the body in the industry who felt that the costs, the social costs, the economic costs, the financial costs of the great financial crisis were enormous, and that a strong voice in favor of a stable financial system against systemic risk was needed. It was the first chair, and the person who established it really was Sheila Bair, who used to be chair of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation here in America, and American members include Paul Volcker and former chairs of the SEC and CFTC and academics and others. And a little before I came on board, it became a transatlantic body with very senior regulators from United Kingdom and continental Europe, including, for example, Nat Velink, who used to chair the Basel Committee, and Adair Turner, who chaired the FSA in London, Sharon Bowles, who chaired the Econ Committee of the European Parliament. And then I persuaded Jean-Claude Trichet, who used to be president of the European Central Bank, to come on board. So we have people ranging from Paul Volcker and Jean-Claude through many senior regulators. In fact, I think there is a former chair of almost every single international financial regulatory body. And we're given independence by the CFAI, and we try and accomplish our mandate of arguing for a stable, resilient financial system.
That is a noble objective, and I wish you the best. So to go back to our former days, I mean, it's roughly a bit more than 10 years since the global financial crisis. So let us not dwell on the past today, but just to do a little bit of that, can you offer us your quick take on what was done in the crisis aftermath to strengthen regulation? I mean, it seems to me that whatever pre-crisis failures and sins that we committed, I think the post-crisis record is positive. There's Basel III, there's the surcharge on the largest banks. They've put in place liquidity and leverage ratios, increased total loss absorbing capacity. You did your excellent work on resolution regimes, and the role of the FSB in global governance was buttressed. Seems that we got much right. You know, we'll turn to the present and future later, but just in terms of the past and what we did immediately after the crisis, I think the system is much stronger and much better, and the authorities did a pretty good job. What are your views?
I think that too. I mean, I'm going to go on and qualify it later on in our discussion, but I think lots of the key fault lines in the international financial system
were addressed and largely remedied. I mean, the big banks have had to increase the amount of common equity they carry relative to their balance sheets by about 10 times. That's a lot. For the first time, they are required to carry liquid assets. So it was a disaster to go into the crisis with so many banks having effectively no liquid assets. The thing I was most involved with in terms of helping to lead, that there weren't adequate policies in place for coping with the failure of big institutions other than going to Congress or Parliament and saying, can you please bail them out? I think a lot of progress has been made with that. It needs to be completed. I think it was a good idea to require vanilla derivative transactions to go through central counterparties, although I think there is a big piece of work left undone there. One area I want to flag immediately where I think enough was not done was with shadow banking. If you re-regulate the banking sector to the extent that everybody has done, you create powerful incentives for the economic substance of banking to move out of what legally are banks. And it'll be part of the story of this crisis, but it's part of the story of the 1920s, 30s crisis in the United States as well. And some measures were taken. The White House here were very focused on parts of shadow banking. I know that because they phoned me to talk about it after I gave a speech on money market mutual funds. And money market mutual funds have been reformed in the face of actually the most extraordinary intensive lobbying I saw in my career. But there's no general policy for shadow banking, and that which is now euphemistically called non-bank finance. And I worry that monitor and then reform will not work, because by the time part of finance is big enough to be a manifest systemic threat, it has lobbying power and can slow down remedies. But, you know, there are things to celebrate and for people like you and I to be reasonably proud of while never thinking that it's been enough.
Well, that's a completely fair assessment, and we can't be satisfied. So as the crisis memories fade, there are inevitably arguments about rolling back regulation, recalibrating the regulatory pendulum to address post-crisis overshoot, as it's called. So what's left to do? What should we be worried about? So I have a few areas to walk you through that one could talk about forever, but I saw a recent TV show where the MC had a lightning round, and he encouraged the speakers to answer fairly quickly the issues. So let me take you through a lightning round on a few questions. So first, the U.S. signed into law in May 2018 a bill providing some regulatory relief. Some called this rollback. My sense is that the bill gave community banks some relief. It left the capital regime little change for the truly big U.S. banks. It gave the Fed some flexibility with respect to banks holding between $100 and $250 billion in assets. How do you see the May 2018 bill, and how do you see the rollback debate in the U.S. more generally? Is rollback happening, or is it just tweaking or recalibrating, and does the post-crisis bank framework remain largely in place?
I think largely in place for the moment. I think what the U.S. did through that bill and other measures for community banks was perfectly fine and sensible. I think the U.S., both Congress and some of the regulatory bodies are complacent about the kind of marginal-led and medium-sized banks. It is a peculiar feature of the post-crisis regime that regulators are very focused on whether the biggest banks and dealers in the world can be resolved without taxpayer solvency support, as they should be. But we hear less about the medium-sized banks. I think it may have been a mistake to relax some of the requirements for the medium-sized banks. Or more accurately, what I believe is, I think that for those measures to have been taken, the chair of the FDIC and either the chair of the Federal Reserve or the vice chair for regulation in the Federal Reserve should have been required to assure Congress that they were completely confident that banks in that range could be resolved in an orderly way without taxpayer support. The FDIC has got an incredible record with small and smaller medium-sized banks. I am not yet convinced that it will be so easy with these banks in the medium size. And it would be a tragedy if there were better planning for the very biggest banks than for these medium-sized banks. And if a number of the medium-sized banks got into trouble at the same time, that would be a crisis. My country, since the Second World War, had two banking crises essentially centered on medium-sized firms, the worst in the 1970s. This is not to be. Medium-sized firms can matter.
Absolutely right. And I remember Ref had a difficult time dealing with IndyMac in the crisis period. Okay, so second question then is, and you've already alluded to it, one of the greatest post-crisis concerns was that activity would gravitate to non-banks. And in that regard, one of the key features of the Dodd-Frank Act was to create the Financial Stability Oversight Council, the FSOC, and the Office of Financial Research, OFR, which were to be the key macroprudential bodies for the U.S. And the FSOC was given the ability to designate systemically significant non-bank financial institutions. My sense is the Trump administration is not interested in using these powers, but maybe that's unfair. But what are your views on this and the state of macroprudential policy in the U.S. more generally?
I do not think the U.S. has done well on this front. The previous administration allowed the perception to grow that the only policy tool available in this area was to designate individual non-banks. That produced an onslaught of lobbying and analysis suggesting that the issue was around activities and functions and services rather than necessarily around individual firms, which, you know, can be largely true, although I wouldn't rule out designating individual non-banks. But the real problem here is, okay, even if one concedes, yes, it's all about activities, so what's the policy on activities? A lobbying or public policy strategy that says it's all about activities, but then is silent on what can be done to ensure that banking-like activities don't give rise to systemic risk is flawed. I think that's most nakedly obvious, perhaps over the last couple of years with the new administration, but I think the seeds of the problem were sown under the previous administration. That's, if you like, something that could be repaired with the powers that are available. The broader point, and I think this couldn't have been avoided, because the window for legislating, passing the Dodd-Frank legislation was so narrow, basically that the short 2 years up to the midterm elections in 2010, Dodd-Frank does the kind of obvious things, but what it doesn't do is establish what most parts of the world would now regard as a more complete macroprudential regime. And that was simply because elsewhere in the world, in the United States, thinking beyond capital for banks, liquidity for banks, derivative clearing, hadn't advanced very far. I think there are a number of countries in Europe, as it happens, including my own, the UK, that has a better system, not only for monitoring risks in the financial system, you can always monitor it, but actually responding in a timely way. We'll have to see whether their systems work, but I think the US has more than one tie behind its back and hasn't thought through how to design a statutory regime for doing so. I think the authorities and the regulators should do so, not because it would get through Congress now, it wouldn't, but to be ready with ideas when an opportunity comes. I mean, that's essentially a good recipe for public policy making for any generation.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. My next lightning round question is the leverage ratio. So there's always been this tension in the U.S. between proponents of assessing capital adequacy on the basis of risk-weighted capital and those who fear gaming the system and wanted a simple leverage ratio. You know, I think that the FDIC, you mentioned Sheila Bair, have typically been in the latter camp. There has other banking regulatory agencies in the U.S. that have been more inclined to look at risk-weighted capital. U.S. banks, probably as a result of this tension, are less levered than European banks. The Fed has been adopting a tailored approach to the enhanced supplementary leverage ratio for the U.S. largest banks. And another aspect that always bothered me, and I pushed hard in my official days to get the FSB and the Basel Committee to look at, was the denominator in risk-weighted assets. And because we were concerned about cross-border measurement equivalent in the denominator. Yeah. And this is one of the reasons why the Basel Committee agreed to floors on risk-weighted assets. And again, that's something that Sheila Bair pushed for hard in the creation of Dodd-Frank. So what do you make about this debate about risk-weighted capital versus leverage ratio?
So my first best would be a much cruder risk-to-asset ratio that essentially adopts the floors thing, where it would be less crude than Basel I. I was the most junior Bank of England official involved in Basel I in the mid-80s, but wouldn't have the extraordinary feature of Basel II, letting banks determine the amount of capital they carry through internal models, which I think was an absolutely inexplicable mistake by the policymakers at the time. The justification for imposing regulation of this kind on banks is that it is completely unreasonable and impossible to expect bankers to internalize the social costs of their own failure. That's why we regulate. So saying that they can then decide the amount of capital they carry through internal models somehow contradicts the very basis for this kind of government intervention. You can't have my first best. I think where we've ended up is pretty good. And something that is often said, and I think is mistakenly said, which is the leverage ratio is a backstop, it shouldn't bite. Well, that's not true at all. If people continue to abuse the flexibility of the risk-weighted system and the internal model system, you should expect the leverage ratio to bite quite a lot. And that was in my mind when I signed up for the leverage ratio. I regret that the Federal Reserve are planning to reduce the leverage ratio requirement for operating banks, even though in a way I'm the high priest of current resolution strategies, and I think that they can work. Even if resolution and so-called bail-in works as well as I think it could, it wouldn't be calm. It just wouldn't be as terrible as in 2008-09. The most important thing is that operating banks don't fail at all to reduce that probability. Allowing equity to move out of operating banks, I think, would be a mistake. And I think it would be a mistake at this point of the economic cycle. There's so much uncertainty about the economy everywhere in the Western world that all the monetary policymakers are bound to make mistakes. They just don't know which side of the thing they're going to make the mistake or how big it would be. The nightmare scenario, I think, would be that we end up with a recession where banks end up being weaker than we expect. And so it is not the moment to relax equity requirements for banks. And that would be the position of the SRC.
Well, thank you for that. So, not a fan of IRB. My last lightning round question for you then would be, what major financial stability risks or vulnerabilities do you see in the U.S.? There's also a bit of a debate going on about using the countercyclical buffer in the U.S. What haven't we talked about that worries other than the shadow bank?
It's hard to know as an outsider exactly where the vulnerabilities might be. But we have had a debt-financed recovery in the Western. Well, that's what monetary policy does. It brings forward spending from the future. And so there's more debt in the corporate sector. New forms of shadow banking have emerged. And at the very least, there's going to be a point where this weighs on the dynamism of the economy. And I don't doubt that there'll be cracks in parts of the financial system that haven't been foreseen. But I think some issues can be foreseen. So our generation of policymakers and the elected leaders who we were at the time mandated derivatives markets to go through central clearing houses. I still think that was a good thing to do. But people on neither side of the Atlantic, are there clear plans and regime for how these clearing houses would be resolved in an orderly way without fiscal support if they fail? And many of the specialist regulators in this field say, oh, we've got great recovery plan. Well, you know, the same could be said of banks. You have to plan for what happens when everything you spent your life doing fails, when your oversight fails, when the waterfall in these clearinghouses proves inadequate, when the default fund can't be replenished. What will happen then? And I would argue that these clearinghouses are super systemic, and it is as obvious that they are that important as it was that Fannie and Freddie and AIG and GE Capital were all non-banks that were, and actually the German Lombard banks that were all completely integral to the international financial system. And it worries me that I think politicians, Congress here, Parliament in Europe should be putting much more pressure on regulators to do something about this. And we'll have to see whether the Systemic Risk Council weighs into this debate.
You reminded me that I worked with Tim Geithner when he was president of the New York Fed back in 2008 to write language into the Washington communique on CP. Followed that up, obviously, in 2009 in the London and Pittsburgh communiques. The U.S. did designate many financial market utilities. And in 2015, I think we certainly urged the FSB to kind of launch an effort in key space, which is ongoing work, but I fully agree with your assessment.
People are working at it, but it's taking too long. And that's passed, but they now really need to do something that's critical. Yeah.
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about the president's attacks on the Fed and central bank independence, and more generally, especially against the background of your book on unelected power, the quest for legitimacy in central banking and regulatory state. I had recently also written a blog for OnFIF in which I strongly defended Fed independence and noted that current debates, which may be reasonable about whether the last monetary policy rate hike was justified or not, shouldn't be conflated with the question of Fed independence and that debate. What thoughts do you have today on attacks on the Fed independence, particularly against the background of the president's commentary on monetary policy?
Central banks are very, very powerful in today's world. They're latently powerful, and it is also suited politicians in nearly all of the advanced economies to sit back and rely on monetary policy and other central bank actions to revive the economy rather than using fiscal policy. And I think opportunities were missed to have fiscally supported infrastructure investment in the United States, for example, which obviously lags behind other parts of the world in its underlying physical infrastructure. And the reliance on central banks has been so great that there is a perception that they can do things that they can't do. Central banks cannot make the economy more dynamic. They cannot improve productivity growth over the medium run. They cannot cure problems and challenges faced by a disaffected middle class who feel as though they've lost some economic hope and actually some dignity and respect over the last 25 years. So I think our societies are in a very awkward place when what appears to be the pinnacle of economic policy can't cure all the problems and challenges that our societies and economies face. So why do I start with that rather than the attacks of the president on the Federal Reserve? Because I think they provide the context for it in a way, and it's not confined to the US. There have been political attacks on the central bank in India, partly I think because of a deeply flawed central bank law in India. There have been periodic attacks on the ECB. There is a review of the Riksbank, the Swedish central bank, going on in Parliament. There is a feeling that central banks are maybe too big for their boots. I think central banks need to encourage, and this is the theme of my book, I think our societies need to give central banks clear mandates where the boundaries are reasonably well defined, that we don't regard them as the US cavalry for every single problem that we face, and then the central bankers should stick within those boundaries and exercise the power they have without doing anything to encourage our populations to think that they can solve all the economic problems. So narrowly, I think the current Fed chair has conducted himself with, if I may say so, exemplary dignity in the face of this, which is just get on with your job, explain to the world that, you know, you're bound to make some mistakes. I mean, there was a taper tantrum in this country a few years ago under Ben Bernanke, which caused a huge stir. And of course, the great thing is, in the monetary policy compared to other parts of public policy, you get 8 goes a year. It's inevitable that they will make mistakes. They can reverse them on the whole. One of the challenges they face is that whatever they make on the soft side or the hard side, if they're perceived to have made a mistake, Wall Street or the City of London or other financiers scream. That gets reported in the newspapers. That gets reflected in Congress. And central bankers need to prioritize their communication with Main Street. Ultimately, they are there to help provide a stable monetary system so that the real economy can flourish. Central banks should be deeply knowledgeable about Wall Street and the City of London and finance. They shouldn't be perceived as being close to it or for it. And the most peculiar thing about political attacks on the central bankers, of course, were they to work, were top central bankers to be change course or whatever and adopt super soft monetary policies, the losers would be the country, because what would happen is that bond yields would rise and the public finances would be under further pressure and there would be less room for maneuver, whether it's a Republican administration wanting to cut taxes or a Democrat institution wanting to increase public expenditure. The benefits to society at large from a stable monetary system, and they're not directed to one part of society rather than another. And that leads me to my final point. Because of the over-reliance on monetary policy, there is a widely held view, which central banks are uncomfortable with, that their policies have had distributional effect. That I think they did. I don't think it's the main source of inequality or anything like that, but they did have distributional effects. And I think they should be more open about this and say, well, actually, Congress or Parliament or whoever can offset it. And that what the central banks aren't doing is making choices to help one part of society over another. And I look forward to a day when central bankers are in the news rather less than they were. I thought that had been the great achievement to pull off 30 years ago.
Wise words. I particularly appreciated your point that a central bank behind the curve can be extremely destabilizing for the health of an economy. And I think also at a time when fiscal policy in our country may be less than ideal, that's very important to preserve a flexible tool for stabilization policy while recognizing the limits of those policies, which is in essence monetary policy. Well, let us wrap up. This has been a fascinating tour d'horizon. I don't think there are many people in the world who command the breadth of experience, expertise to cover such large terrain so succinctly and intelligently. I greatly thank you, Paul Tucker.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's been a real privilege to be here.